Thank you, everyone, for coming here today. I do apologize for being late. I did hit traffic. Luckily, it was on both the Merit and 91, so I won't be cursing myself for picking the Merit today. So I hit it in both places. And that's it today. We have presentations from OPM and from Office of Higher Education. And so I think that I'll just turn it over to Roberta to see if you had any opening remarks, and then we'll get started.
No, thank you. Before we do introductions, for those of you who don't know me, I'm State Representative Roberta Willis. I chair Higher Education Employment Advancement Committee. I just want to say the one thing that's not on the agenda, and I'm hoping we have time for, and that would be a little bit of a discussion or some thoughts about moving forward. I have some questions that I'd like to pose to the members of this group that might be helpful in thinking about where we go next. So with that, why don't I pass the mic to Carrie?
Good morning. I'm Carrie Kelly. I'm with the Office of Policy and Management, and I'm a section director overseeing education and workforce programs there.
I'm Shaurav Guha. I also work at the Office of Policy and Management. Carrie's my section director.
Steve McDowell from the Board of Regents of Higher Education, the Assistant Director of Financial Aid Services.
Greg DeSantis, Associate Director of Financial Aid at Housatonic Community College and from the Faculty Advisory Committee.
Jeanette Weldon, Executive Director of the Connecticut Higher Education Supplemental Loan Authority.
Judy Resnick, Chair of the Planning Commission.
Mark French, Director of Student Financial Aid with the Office of Higher Education.
Rich Bishop, Director of Financial Aid, Central Connecticut State University.
Jane Charleglio, Office of Higher Education.
Jen Widnes, the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Alan Shepard, Office of Fiscal Analysis.
We've had someone join us.
I'm Greg Haddad, State Representative from Mansfield.
Thank you, and I'm James Maroney, a former state representative and a member of the Planning Commission and of this subcommittee, the working group. Okay. So,
Carrie?
So, good morning. This morning I'm going to talk a little bit about an overview of state financial aid or student financial aid in the state of Connecticut. There's a green and white presentation. Jeannie has them over at her desk if you don't have it, and we could follow along. The state supports institutions of higher education in four primary ways. Direct appropriations to public institutions. This is commonly referred to as block grants. This is the one most people think of most frequently. It's the one you hear the most about. But we're trying to draw attention to another significant way the state supports institutions of higher education, and that's indirect appropriations to public institutions. And that comes in the form of general fund fringe benefits support. I think it's gone underrepresented, and it's a significant contribution. It any employees who are supported by the public institution's block grant, which is general fund, their fringe benefits are supported by the general fund as well. And that is not given directly to the institution, but rather it's budgeted and paid for out of the comptroller's accounts, and the expenditures occur there. So when you're talking about the total state expenditure for higher education, this frequently goes underreported. The third way the state supports institutions is capital funding, bond dollars, and that occurs at the public institutions. And finally, and probably most directly appropriate today, are appropriations for student financial aid for Connecticut students attending both public and private institutions in the state. So we'll be looking at student financial aid by source. So that would be federal sources, state sources, and institutional sources. And the institutional sources occur from tuition set-asides or philanthropy. When talking about it at UConn, you can see that in FY15, which is the academic year 14-15, the bulk of student financial aid came from institutional resources, about 66%. federal resources with approximately 24 and state resources 10. It's a little bit of a different story at the Board of Regents. At the community colleges, nearly 92% of student financial aid came from federal resources, 5% from state, and 16% for institutional. Similar stories at the state universities in Charter Oak. Really, it's federal sources that provide the bulk of aid here. A very different story at the private college by sector. You could see that 89% of student financial aid came from institutional resources, 2% from state, and 9% from federal. I think what you can see here is there's a common story that state-funded student financial aid is really a minor part of a much larger picture. I think it's the one that we have most direct control over, but it's really a small part of a big question and problem. So when you're talking about changing systems of student financial aid, we really have most direct control over state-funded financial aid, which comes in the form of governor scholarship, but I don't think you can really fix the system or correct any of the inequities that are perceived when you really only control a small fraction of the dollars, probably somewhere on the order of 5 to 7% cumulatively. And finally, I'll leave you with the current year student financial aid to public and private institutions. This is in the form of the governor's scholarship by sector. So I think we'll pause there. Is there any questions or observations?
I just wanted to mention that I think another way that the state is supportive is through CHESLA, because we issue state-backed bonds in order to fund our student loans, and those loans are effectively revenue to the schools.
Yeah, I think that's an important part. Absolutely. Oh, did we skip a slide? Also, I want to talk about... Sorry, I failed to mention this one as well, which is the state funding for student financial aid. This is for the what is now currently the governor scholarship that was constituted in FY14. Prior to that, there were three programs: capital scholarship, what is referred to as KICS that went to the private institution, and CAPS that went to the public. And so you can see that there's the high water mark of funding occurred in FY08. And we're below that now, so the pie has certainly gotten smaller over time.
Does anyone have any questions?
Representative Betts, did you want to join us? Okay, come on.
Does anyone have any questions for OPM? Carrie, I believe you'll be here the whole meeting, right? So if they think of a question later on.
I will, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Mark, are you going to do the presentation? Okay. And so now Mark will present about the Governor's Scholarship Program. Mark French from Office of Higher Education.
Trying to figure out the best way so I don't block the projector here. Okay. Thank you again. I'm Mark French, the Director of Student Financial Aid with the Office of Higher Education. And I'd like to give a sort of a high-level overview of the Governor's Scholarship Program and how it plays into the financial aid picture in the state of Connecticut. Sorry, it's not changing screens here. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for sitting too long. Okay, I'd like to give a little background of and the goals of the Governor's Scholarship Program. The program was signed into law in 2013 and codified under Section 10A-173 of the General Statutes. It was designed to replace the Capital Scholarship Program, the Connecticut Aid for Public College Student Grants Program, the Connecticut Independent College Student Grant Program, and the Charter Oak State College Grant Program. Those were the prior programs that were providing financial aid to students in the state of Connecticut. So it was a consolidation of those programs into one single new program. The goals of the Governor's Scholarship Program are to provide state residents with a consistent higher education financial aid program, which ensures fair and equitable awards, regardless of the type of Connecticut college, public or private, the student attends. Encourage students to attend full-time by offering them significantly higher award amounts to do so. Guarantee that Connecticut's neediest students at community colleges have their tuition fees and books paid for by the federal Pell Grant or a combination of Pell Grant and GSP funds. It rewards students for superior academic performance and timely degree completion. And it provides students who excel in high school with an enhanced Governor's Scholarship Award. Also, it supports the overall state goals of increasing persistence and degree completion of the students in Connecticut. For a student to be eligible for the Governor's Scholarship Award, they need to be a resident of the state of Connecticut, attend an eligible Connecticut institution of higher education, and those are primarily the not-for-profit independents and the public colleges and universities, file the free application for federal student aid, or what is termed the FAFSA, and as a result of filing that, have a valid expected family contribution, or EFC. They also must be enrolled in an undergraduate degree-granting program. They need to be enrolled as a part-time student, either between 6 or 11 credits, or a full-time student, 12 or more credits. And finally, they must be in good academic standing at the institution of higher education that they're attending. Okay, within the Governor's Scholarship Program, there are actually three separate components or sort of sub-programs. The first is what we call the Governor's Scholarship Program Need Merit component. This really is the replacement version of the old Capital Scholarship Program. And this provides funds directly to eligible students who have SAT score of 1800 or ACT score of 27 and or in the top 20 percentile of their high school class. Both full-time and part-time students are eligible, and for the 2014-15 academic year, or FY15, 2,453 students received awards under this program. Then we have the GSP need-based program. This program most closely relates to the old KICS and CAPS program. It provides GSP funds to institutions directly in order to make awards to eligible students. Both full-time and part-time students are eligible for this award. And for the 14-15 academic year, 15,783 students received an award under this component. And finally, and this is new under the Governor's Scholarship Program, never existed before, but something that we felt was very important to incorporate in the new program, we call it the Academic Incentive Award. And this provides additional GSP funds, need-based funds, to students who received a need-based grant in the prior year and finished the prior year with at least 30 completed credits and a minimum GPA within the award cohort's range for that year. Only full-time students are eligible for this award, and for 14-15, 602 students received an incentive award. That incentive award is on top of whatever need-based Governor Scholarship Award they may be getting in the current year also. So it's in addition to. Yes. The amount of
what
the
is
award,
the amount of the incentive award?
Yeah, the amount of the award has changed over the past 2 years. It's somewhat based on how much we have available in funding and then how many students are eligible, but it's ranged from $1,000 to $1,200 in additional money for the year.
Mm. Mark, if you could tell folks how much is the merit and how much is the need.
Yeah, next screen will show that.
Sorry.
Okay. No, that's all right. That's all right. Good question. Okay, that's fine. Okay, the next screen shows what we call the award matrix that we send out to all the eligible schools each year that gives them the EFC range that's approved for the coming academic year and the award amounts that can be given to students who have EFCs within that range. The one column I have added for the purposes of this presentation that is not on the matrix that goes out to the schools that the school folks may pick up on is the average income. We talk in the financial aid world in terms of EFC, but sometimes for the rest of the folks, average income makes a little more sense than EFC. So that's where we have the EFC. So what we have for a student in a four-year program, if they have an EFC between $0 and $6,999, they could qualify for up to a $3,000 need-based award, or they could get a $5,000 need merit award. Students can no longer get both. Under the old programs, a student could get a need-based award through Kicks or Caps and a capital scholarship. Now it's one or the other. And you can see the next range of EFCs is $7,000 to $8,999. 2,500 need-based, 4,500 merit, and then 9,000 to 10,999, 2,000 or 4,000 for the merit. Two-year programs, it's a little bit different because of the change in the overall cost, the lower cost. We go from $0 to $5,198. You may wonder, where did that come from? That was the year's cap for the EFC for Pell Grant. And that'll make a little more sense in a moment. They can get between $3,000 or $3,500 for a merit. And then you can see as it goes up, we have more EFC ranges for the two-year program students. And then it goes down to a minimum of $1,000 need-based or $1,500 need merit. Now, what we do with the two-year program students, and primarily this is affects community college students, because the cost is still so low, we're fortunate for tuition and fees and the $1,000 that we add in for books. Students who receive a full Pell Grant have the tuition and fees and that $1,000 in books covered by the Pell Grant. So if that's the case, that student would not be eligible for Governor's Scholarship. Governor's Scholarship starts kicking in after the Pell Grant is applied if it leaves any amount left owed of the tuition and fees plus $1,000 for books. They can get Governor Scholarship up to that amount until Pell Grant phases out. And then once Pell Grant phases out at the $5,199, you can see then they get the Governor Scholarship award if they're eligible. Now, I do want to point out these are not entitlement programs. So, unfortunately, we do not have the funds in either the need merit nor the need based to necessarily make an award to everybody who qualifies. So, you know, the schools have discretion on giving out the need-based amount of money that they get, the block of money that they get, but once it's gone, it is gone. And the same happens with the need merit that our office administers. Once we've given out that allocation, unfortunately, there's no ability to fund additional students. Down at the bottom of this chart, you see the part-time award amounts. And you can see for a four-year program, 6 to 8 credits. We just have one range of EFCs, 0 to 1099. And they can get, didn't move those columns over right. The need-based is 650. The need merit is 800. And then if they're taking 9 to 11 credits, they could get need-based of 900 or $1,000 in the need merit. Any questions on that?
I just have one question. So looking at this, so 6 to 8 credits, mm-hmm. The difference for the need merit is $150, yet 9 to 11 credits, the difference is only $100 bump.
Correct.
For having the merit. Why would they take more credits and get less of a bump?
One of the things we have to be careful of is the need merit has to be higher by statute than the need-based awards. And then when we're looking at the full-time with the additional academic incentive grant, we have to count that in, that a student could get that there. But as we'll talk in a minute, there is the overall discussion of the part-time awards anyway. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. Okay, one of the other things, after last meeting's presentation by the Education Commission of the States that Sarah Pingle gave, I wanted to tie in how the Governor's Scholarship Program works or meets the principles of financial aid redesign that they have put out. And just as a reminder, the first of the four is financial aid programs should be student-centered. Financial aid programs should be goal-driven and data-informed. Financial aid programs should be timely and flexible. And financial aid programs should be broadly inclusive of all students' educational pathways. So if we look at the Governor's Scholarship against each one of those principles, for Principle 1, financial aid programs should be student-centered, the Governor's Scholarship Program was designed to provide state residents with a consistent higher education financial aid program, which ensures fair and equitable awards regardless of the type of Connecticut college, public or private, the student attends. That was not the case under the old KICS and CAPS programs. Principle 2, financial aid programs should be goal-driven and data-informed. Well, this gets into sort of an institutional requirement. To be eligible to receive the need-based funds as an institution, that institution must submit a student data report at the end of each academic year. And that report provides the data which will be necessary to track the effectiveness of the Governor's Scholarship Program in meeting state goals. So it's data-informed through that report. Principle 3, financial aid programs should be timely and flexible. The Governor's Scholarship Program was designed to meet the higher education goals of the state of Connecticut in the 21st century, replacing the KICS, CAPS, and Capital Program, which were designed to meet goals which were relevant more than 30 years ago. Obviously, you all know the financial aid in the college-bound world has changed dramatically. Additionally, the Governor's Scholarship Program allows for program flexibility to adjust for changing trends in the future. Principle 4, financial aid programs should be broadly inclusive of all students' educational pathways. The inherent flexibility designed into the Governor's Scholarship Program allows the state to be more responsive to the meeting new goals, such as possibly the funding of students in limited workforce-defined certification programs. Okay, now we know that... Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much. I had a question on that last principle. And curious as to whether you know if there's been an increase demand or participation by students going into, for example, like VOTEC schools to become involved in getting jobs in the private sector like manufacturing or things of that nature.
I do not have that information. I'm not sure whether anybody else here has that.
I would offer that certain certificate programs offered through our community colleges have had incredible enrollment and demands put upon them, that there's a lot of interest among the students. And so I'm very encouraged to hear that our Governor's Scholarship Program has the flexibility to possibly provide aid to workforce programs as well.
Thank you for that. And one of the other questions I have, and you may not know it, and I'll ask somebody else who may have that information, as to how much money we plan or has been set aside to meet the goals of the Principle 4?
Well, currently no money has been planned or set aside because it's not something that is done in the program. Certainly it would probably come under the allocation amount that each school gets for the need-based if certificate programs were added to the Governor's Scholarship as an approved pathway for students. The schools would have their discretion how much of that block of money they get that they would want to use to fund certificate students. But again, it won't meet, obviously, everybody.
Maybe I missed. Go ahead, Judy.
I actually want to follow up on the flexibility piece. I guess I'm struggling with if you don't set aside dollars for specific work-based programs that are in need, how has this flexibility principle been applied so far? Maybe that's the question I need to know.
Just maybe to clarify, I think that what we were trying to say was that it's possible, because we heard the discussion in the last couple of meetings, that this is possible with the flexibility. Just to be clear, we haven't done that yet, but we were trying to respond to some discussion that you guys have had in the past.
But to follow on the certificate program, actually the manufacturing programs that Carrie's talking about are credit bearing, so they would qualify regardless for a student going through them. So there are about 30 credits in total for the two semesters that they go through. So they would be treated as any other scholarship applicant, I would assume, as well, too. So I don't know that they need special. We need to talk later on about whether or not there's any flexibility in looking at our goals that we've set for the Planning Commission and how we can align, you know, some of the resources to meet some of those goals as well. So thanks.
And I think that might be something, you know, that this body would want to consider moving forward, but recognizing that without additional funding added to the Governor's Scholarship Program, all other parts would be reduced correspondingly. So, it's a policy consideration.
Okay, one of the other...
Hold on 1 minute, please, Mark. Jen?
Mark, on the data piece, we've been reporting data for a couple of years. Does OHE have any plans to do a report on the outcomes? Or?
Yeah, we currently have 2 years. We'll have 3 years at the end of this year of Governor's Scholarship data. It really will take at least 4 years to begin to get a picture of, and maybe up to 6 years, since that's how long we're allowing students to receive Governor's Scholarship. But certainly it'll be at least until we get the data after the fourth year that I think we could start looking at anything that would make sense to us yet. So we're light years ahead of where we were. We're building to that direction. And, at some point we'll certainly be able to generate comprehensive reports. Okay. One of the things that we know and have heard of is the issue of the awards for part-time students under the Governor's Scholarship Program. And I just wanted to point out a couple of things as we look at it. For the 2012-13 academic year, and that was the last full year of the old programs, in this case for the community colleges, the CAPS program, the average award for students attending part-time in 2013-14 was $855 for the year. The average part-time award for the fall-spring of 14-15 would be approximately $775. So we're very close there anyway. Doesn't mean, it's not a point of discussion, but I just wanted to point that out, what it looks like currently. The second point, the community college awarded $2.7 million in CAPS funds to 2,274 students with ESCs above their cost of tuition fees and $1,000 for books, and this is no longer allowed under GSP. Now, that's not to say that the community colleges were doing anything wrong. It's just to point up one of the items under the old CAPS program that was becoming problematic, particularly as we started losing funding in the financial aid programs. The appropriations were going down. So the Governor's Scholarship Program, that's one of the areas that it looked to change and if you will, make more equitable. And the third is somewhat similar. 12,679 students with EFCs between 0 and 1,000 received no CAPS funds. Now, again, not that anybody was doing anything wrong. It just was a fact of how that program could work. And also, it's a reflection, too, of less funding than is really needed by a lot of students. Under the KICS program, there were some similar reasons why we felt we had to modernize and update the programs. In 12-13, the last year of the KICS program, the private college and universities reported that 1,257 students with EFCs above 20,000, which works out to an average income of about 128,000, were awarded $862,317 in KICS funds. Again, nobody was doing anything wrong. It just... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't put the space. I'm sorry. It's 257. Thank you very much. Yeah. Again, not to imply that any school was doing anything incorrect. It was allowable under the program, the old program. But again, it's something that we felt, again, with the diminishing amount of funds that were available, we need to be able to get the funds out to the needier students in a more equitable manner. And then of the above, 126 students who had family incomes over 150,000, had EFC incomes over 150,000, they were awarded $420,658 in TICS funds. Again, it was allowable under the old program, but perhaps not the best use of limited state dollars. And finally, similar to the CAPS program, under TICS program, 2,914 students with EFCs of zero received no TICS funds. Again, not that any school is doing anything wrong. It just was how the program operated and how the funding was available or not available.
Clarification, is that the 2,900 students, is that they didn't receive TICS because there's unmet need?
There's several reasons for it that could be possible. Number one, again, even in the TICS program, there was a limited amount that each school received. So once they gave it out, they gave it out. That could be part of it, sort of students who were a little later in the process for whatever reason, the money was already committed. It's more also to kind of point up, which might tie into the next slide, under either program, Governor Scholarship or the old TICS and CAPS, as the appropriations were reduced, the potential for this to happen to needier students obviously is there. So that points up that also that, some of our neediest students were left without.
Jen? I think also what I've heard from financial aid directors, and this is one of the, we're not going back to kicks, whatever, but I think that a lot of times our institutions will serve the neediest students first with institutional aid and federal grant aid, and so the students that have zero EFC obviously can't attend our institutions without substantial amount of institutional and federal aid. So occasionally I think that the state dollars were used for students with in the middle ground and to fill that gap. So a student with zero EFC would definitely get a Pell Grant. They definitely qualify for need-based institutional aid. And so that's perhaps why that number was what it was.
Other questions?
I guess now we'll open it up for questions.
I have one more slide.
Okay, one more slide.
One final slide that I wanted to end on, because I think, to me, and I think many people in this room, this is really the crux of what we're faced with. Regardless of what type of financial aid program or mechanism we have for getting the aid out to the students, this, I think, summarizes what we're all up against. And it's the declining state appropriations. It's not a surprise to most of us, but I just wanted to kind of put it before all of us. You can see since FY11, there's been a significant drop, which we have all felt. Certainly at the financial aid office level, you all have felt that, be it public or private. We felt it with the need merit program that we have to administer. But I just wanted to leave it on note that this is really where I feel our efforts need to be focused. Thank you.
Okay, I guess we'll open it up to questions. Mark, thank you very much for the presentation. Do you want to ask a question first?
I just want a comment on this slide, and I think it's important for a couple of reasons. To look at Carrie's slide on state funding for financial aid, to recognize that we really almost added a third more money in 2008. So in some respects, if you look back, if you compare where we are today with 2005, 6, and 7, we're kind of in the same ballpark, if not ahead. What's changed is that also the tuition is going, so the costs have gone over that time frame. But I think it's important for folks to see that there was a huge bump, and we've been working our way down. which actually will lead me to another conversation that I think is important as we look at this whole financial aid. And that's one of the state goals in the strategic plan is affordability and access. And what I'd like to know, and I'm not sure I talked to Carrie about this, is, okay, we added about $20 million a year in 2008, 2009, 2010, and 2011. What happened? You know, what were the outcomes for that? Did that mean awards were larger? Did more students get the awards? But in the final outcome, did more students have access? So enrollment went up? Did completion go up? You know, those are all questions that I think that we need to measure. And this is where Jeanette, with the loan component, when it dropped down and if enrollment didn't change drastically, did that mean that more students were borrowing? Because I have a feeling that we need to look at that, because for me that fits one of the goals of the strategic plan, and that's the impact on the economy. So if you're looking at, you know, increased student debt, has that in fact been what's supplanted what we were doing in financial aid? That students are going, but they're just borrowing more. And as far as I'm concerned, this committee should be just as concerned with that as that we are how much they're getting in an award. Are we actually moving them to take out more loans? And we've seen what the impact of that has been on the economy and will continue to be on the economy. So I just want to make that philosophical comment right here at this point, and I hope you don't mind.
Thanks, Roberta. And I think now I'd like to open it up for questions. I just want to kind of open with a little bit of an apology to Mark that I have a list of questions to ask, and normally when I do that, I send them ahead of time. Unfortunately, I did it all last night at 11 o'clock, and so I didn't think you would be ready. So if the answer is I'll get back to you, that's perfectly acceptable to me. I'll leave it open to other people to ask their questions, so hopefully they're answered before you get to me. The other thing I just want to say is I think a long time ago I remember reading on Connecticut College's financial aid website and just explaining again that it was a partnership, but that it's an imperfect process, and we understand that, but it's the process we have, right? And they're trying to assess need of individual students. Here, in a way, we're assessing need of individual students, but also assessing the need of the institution. So we understand that it's not going to be a perfect process, that not everyone is going to be happy, but we need to work together to make it better. So with that, I'll open it up to questions for Mark. Jen?
I know, right? Sorry. So can you just explain, I don't know if everybody, how is the money, you have three programs within one program, and so how does the money get divided up each year?
It's a good question. Each year we get an appropriation from the state. Now how does that then get divvied up into the various components of Governor's Scholarship? In the statute, it actually defines how we are to allocate the overall appropriation to the different components. So there are percentages talked about in the statute. So there's an amount, minimum of 20%, that goes into the need merit. There's an amount that we're required to put towards the academic incentive. It's 2%. I believe it's 2. And then there's an amount that we are to give towards the need-based, which is up to 80%. Now, that's how we fill the buckets for the three different programs, if you will. Well, how does that then filter down to the school level? Well, the need merit is really what we call a direct student. So it filters down to the school by the student choosing the school they're ultimately going to attend, and we send the money to the school. So there's no guaranteed amount a school would get under the need merit because it's portable with the student. Under the need based, what we look at, that's the money where the school will get, say, $500,000 of the available appropriation. How do we determine who gets $500,000, who gets $600,000, who gets $1 million? It's based off of the prior year. That's one of the reasons we get the student data report. The prior year enrollment of students who would be eligible for a governor's scholarship. So that, again, those eligibility requirements, Connecticut residents with EFCs at a four-year from 1099 down, or at a community college, 799 down. So we add all that up. So I have a gross number of eligible students at the 4 years and a gross number at the 2 years. I don't want to get too complex with the formula, but basically we use those two numbers then and look within those groups, what percentage of that overall number, so what percentage does the Sacred Heart have of the overall four-year school, what percentage does UConn have, what percentage does Central have, what percentage does Fairfield, and they get the equivalent dollar amount of that bucket of money. Same with the community colleges. Of the money for the community colleges, what percent does Housatonic have, what percent does Middlesex have, what percent does Nuntuck have. And then those schools receive that money in two increments, half for the fall, half for the spring, and they then determine the students within the eligibility ranges, the EFC ranges, that they will give the funds to. The academic incentive award is a little different. It operates where we, from the reports, we pick the students who are eligible based on first who completed 30 or more credits at the schools. And because the funds are limited each year, we run a run by GPA, highest GPA first. So 30 or more credits and then by GPA, and we run down the GPA list until the funds are gone. So that determines the floor of the academic performance for that year. That could move from year to year. And then what we do with that is it's somewhat like the Need Merit Award. We send the funds out to the school for the students who are in attendance at their school who are eligible for the Academic Incentive Award. So I hope, nutshell, that kind of big nutshell, that helped.
How do the part-time students get counted? So
part-time students are counted for, well, each, this is where it gets complex in the formula, but each student can be worth up to 1 point per semester. So a student who's attending both semesters as a full-time student would equal 2 points. We have to do a point value to all this. Part-time students are, and I have it down here, part-time students are counted at a lower, let me just flip that page real quickly here. Part-time students who are 6 to 8 credits are counted as 0.075 per semester. And part-time students who are 9 to 11 are counted as 0.125 per semester. So you can have all different combinations. You can have a student who's full-time one semester and 6 credits the next semester. So that would add up to a certain value. So we add up all those points. The reason why the part-timers are not an equivalent sort of proration down of the 1% is because the awards are not a proration down from 100%. So it wouldn't work mathematically with the money. And then that gets back into the whole question about part-timer awards. But that's how we do it.
So when you look at the total, for the report that each institution sends, and you're counting like a needy student as 2.
No, it's a full-time student.
A needy full-time student is 2 points.
Right.
Do you take into account the bands or not? Is it just?
It's anybody at the 4 years,
right,
who has an EFC from 0 to 10999.
Okay.
If a 0 EFC is full-time, they're 2 points. If a 10,900 is full-time, they're 2 points. And same at the community colleges, just with a different band.
At what time is that allocation determined? Like, when do you know, and when can we let the schools know? I mean, obviously, they're not going to know a dollar amount, but for planning purposes, it may be helpful to them to know their percentage of the
the pie?
We have to wait to get the student data report, and that is dependent on really the end of the school year and giving the schools, you know, several weeks to get final grades and GPAs and all put together. That process can take a little while. What I generally do is ask for the report sometime in mid-June. It then takes several weeks to go through those reports, clean them up, work with the schools on some of the data that maybe needs to be looked at again. So by mid-July, again, we're also, depending on that year's budget scenario, you know, if it's late and us knowing how much we're going to be appropriated.
So mid-July, meaning after they've already packaged
Correct.
The students. Okay.
Correct.
Now, I have a question, and I understand that's the process, right, in the way it is. Are there any, do we have enough data to look? I know federally we're just going to prior for the FAFSA, and they've studied it, the low-income people, year to year, their income really doesn't change that much. They feel it'll be a reliable indicator. Do we have any historical data to show how much the proportion will change from year to year if we could go to prior for allocating percentages here? So at least for planning purposes, again, it would be, I feel it may be helpful to the colleges.
You know, maybe the colleges are doing more work in that area for their individual populations. To my thinking, we still need to know the pattern of attendance, regardless of the, that would more affect the EFC spread. But we need from those reports really to see what the pattern of attendance.
Judy?
If I can follow on, because if I'm hearing this right then, so if the colleges, let's say mid-July, begin to understand what's happening, but yet they've already packaged the aid, it's almost, you know, too late. So I'm wondering, you know, and I certainly agree with you that you need data, and we have to. I mean, the only way we're ever going to figure out the effectiveness of this stuff is to track it. But what do you think the impact might be if we were to say, we'll continue to collect current year data, but if we award it on prior, what are the ups and downs of that?
Well, I mean, that's sort of what the government's going to with the FAFSA, with the prior year. The first thing to understand is there would be 2 years in a row where you'd use the same data. Yeah, may not be a big deal. However, we still have to wait for the state appropriation. So, and this is no different really than the kicks and caps process. The thing that is different there is the schools had the benefit of years of consistent processing, and the aid was, you know, the programs were the same, so they got into a mold, which is very important for them to know what to expect. We're only into our third year of governor scholarship, and there were some factors that kind of, it's just now settling down into what it should look like year after year for the schools to get into that modeling. So that's a difficult thing up until now.
I mean, just as an aside, as a parent who did put two kids through college, July was too, and July is almost, it's an anticlimactic event, both for the institution and for the family, because the decision usually has been made before then. So I think anything that we can do together to try to figure out how to make that process a little more expeditious and transparent would help both the institutions, help you. I mean, clearly it's going to give you some assistance, so I just wanted to insert
one of the things, and Jen, certainly I'll speak sort of on behalf of the 4 years. The 2 years are a little bit different in their awarding process, but what most of the four-year colleges tend to try to do is pre-award. Now, again, because they had some historical knowledge on kicks and caps, it was a little easier for them just getting into that governor scholarship. But very few schools, if any that I know of in Connecticut, would not show a state aid, be it kicks or caps or governor scholarship, on an award notice in, say, March, because they didn't know until July what the amount would be. And correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I mean, I think that the problem has been, from what I've heard, though, is because, I mean, it's been a tough budget cycle for now 4 or 5 years. So no, but people are just not awarding it.
Yeah.
And because they don't know what they're going to get. And like you said, it is a lot of contingent on the budget cycle. But, I mean, I think that what James is trying to get to, and I agree, is that if we could have some sense of this last chart that Carrie had, sort of like the breakdown by institution in March, then at least we would know, even though, I mean, because we knew there was going to be a 10% cut to Governor's Scholarship this year, and that's what everybody budgeted for, and then they didn't get that. It fluctuated more than that, so then they were shocked. And I know what you're going to say is that the set-aside sort of changed things. The set-aside sunsetted. There used to be a set-aside in Governor's Scholarship for the first 2 years, and that went away this year, which is probably why things changed so much, so that if we give it a few more years, it'll probably look like this most of the time. That is what it is. But I think that if at least we could agree, if you use prior, and we had a sense of the breakdown on percentage, then as we track the budget, this isn't a grant program that typically takes a huge cut at the end of the budget cycle. And that's what we used to be able to do for them, is that we knew the breakdown on kicks and caps, we knew what the formula was for Connecticut students. So, you know, Mark, I mean, we would send them their estimated based on whatever a prop's budget was, based on the governor's budget, and they could plan. And I think the problem is now they're so timid about awarding that they aren't awarding as much because they just have no idea. And so, but like I know you're going to say, it'll get more predictable in the next few years.
I mean, it really will. You're absolutely right. I'm not, and we had talked about trying to get the data earlier to try to move it up. I mean, we're, and it's the institutions. I mean, that's the end of the year for them. So. And I do think that with the phase out of kicks and caps, it will get a little more predictable. I mean, I don't think there's a disagreement here. It's going to take some time. It's a new program to sort of roll out for the institutions to figure out, you know, what their basic, and then step back with the appropriation and try to figure out what they can award.
I had a question about just figuring out how the state goal of college of affordability relates to the way that we allocate to institutions the portion of the governor's scholarship. And when I go back and I look at your chart where you added in a very helpful way the average income for a family. Mm-hmm. And that sits next to an EFC range. Mm-hmm. But correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to understand this. EFC is sensitive to the tuition charged by the institution.
No, EFC, the expected family contribution, is a number that is determined through the federal congressional needs analysis formula.
Okay, and that's good. It's helpful to me. It's not related to the amount that a family would be expected to pay to go to a particular institution.
It is. It's a number that the government says a family can pay for 1 year of college based on their financial data on the FAFSA and some other family issues.
But it's not a difference between what they can afford and what an institution would charge.
Correct. If I had a $10,000 EFC, what I was expected to pay at UConn would be different than what I was expected to pay at Housatonic, because it's the cost of attendance minus the EFC leaves what's called financial need. And it's that financial need that is looking to be filled with as much and from as many sources of aid as possible. So the EFC plays into that.
Does anyone else have questions? I have a list, so I'll. If no one else is going to go, Roberta.
I actually, we've heard from Jen. I'd actually like to hear from the Publix. You're on the spot, you two, since you're the only two here. I'd like to hear what? Just your reaction to this conversation about the prior.
So one of the things we've experienced, and I think Mark highlighted on it, is the cap on what we can award as far as only meeting the needs of tuition, fees, and books. Previously, we at the community colleges did go beyond that to fill what Mark was just explaining, you know, you have your cost of attendance, you subtract out your EFC, and that's a real financial need. And then what this program has done is essentially shrink that need a little bit and limited it to just tuition, fees, and books, and left out essentially transportation, medical costs, other school-related expenses. So in that sense, that's where we've seen a little bit of a difference in the programs from CAPS to the GSP.
One of the things we've also discussed, or we've had sort of preliminary conversations about, is just the fact that if OHE told the community colleges today how much we're getting for fall, we wouldn't be able to allocate that to students, because at the community colleges it's very different than at the 4 years in terms of part-time students and the way our student information system banner works. I think this goes for all the directors as they've spoken about it collectively at the community colleges. We can't actually award that money until about 3 weeks into the semester. So the governor's scholarship is a little bit different for us because we can't award it in that timely manner. The reason for that is because a student's enrollment at the community colleges changes frequently, and that could be up or down. So, for example,
Daily, yeah.
If a student were to decide during the first week of classes that he or she wants to move from 9 credits of enrollment, so 3/4 time, to full time, that jump in aid under the governor's scholarship program would be quite a bit of money. And we may have already allocated that money to another student and may have no way to make up that difference for that student. Same thing if a student decides, you know, I can't quite handle that workload, I'm going to go from full time to 9 credits. All of a sudden their aid drops potentially from, say, $1,500 if they're full-time to maybe $450 if they are part-time. So a substantial difference, especially when we're talking about a cost for full-time students at the community colleges of about $2,000. So because governor's scholarship doesn't prorate in a way similar to Pell Grants, what the directors have been talking about at the community colleges is that there's really no way for us to allocate those funds ahead of time, even in an estimate format, because it's so different for each student. Once we get to sort of the census date where we've finalized enrollment for the semester about 3 weeks in. So as a result, even the prior year shift, although useful, it would be useful, won't make a difference unless the governor's scholarship were prorated in a manner that mirrors what Pell Grant does, which is that if you're a 3/4 time student, you get 3/4 of your Pell Grant for the semester. If you're a half time student, you get half your Pell Grant for the semester. And the tuition and fees at the community colleges sort of mirror that as well, in that your tuition and fees are probably roughly half what they would be if you're a half time student compared to if you're a full time student. So if the governor's scholarship was, you know, as again, we've sort of had preliminary discussions about, if the governor's scholarship was allocated in a way that mirrored the Pell Grant, it would allow us to be more timely in our awarding of students. I understand that the original intent of the governor's scholarship is to ensure full-time enrollment, and that's really important for our students. Full-time enrollment is what we encourage. Full-time enrollment is something that we know is critical for students to progress to a degree or transfer. At the same time, we know that there are students that simply can't do that, or students who have circumstances that shift even as the semester is starting. And we know that I think a lot of data shows now that persistence is actually one of the most important things for community college students, making sure that community college students persist from semester to semester. And the issue, if we were to award governor's scholarship beforehand, is that we would possibly interfere with that persistence for any given student due to bills that might come up because we can't cover the shift in their enrollment. And as a result, the program has become, I think the directors would agree that it's a little bit difficult to administer in a timely fashion for that reason.
And that kind of piggybacks on
Greg, I have a question for you. The census date, when is that? So let's say for the spring semester, when would that census date, when you've determined enrollment for the semester?
Mid-February, early to mid-February.
Which puts us at a real hard spot because there is a February 15th deadline, so we really scramble.
That was my next question.
And that was
the deadline is February 15th to return the unencumbered funds, correct?
I believe the legislation says it has to be obligated. However, that's defined. I'm not.
Okay. Sure. And so there's no – is that a codified or
– Yes.
Yeah.
So that would need to – so would moving that date give you more flexibility?
Absolutely. Especially if, based on the discussion that was had at the last meeting, if we wanted to include summer, awarding in the summertime.
But at the same time, recognizing that moving that date to later, if prior year or something like that isn't being used, just makes it more difficult for OHE to get us the next year's information, right, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I mean, it's the same process. It's just the schools need to understand it's going to be on the time frame that we're currently on.
Right.
Yeah, and there's not much we can do with those variables.
On the issue of part-time students, would the cost of attendance for those part-time students that are the neediest, wouldn't that be met in full by Pell?
In this case, some of it's met by Pell. So, but for, you know, students who have full Pell, where everything's being covered, it's unlikely that we're going to be awarding them Governor's Scholarship because since, as Steve pointed out, we're just covering tuition fees and books with Governor's Scholarship and not any other need-based costs, those students are unlikely to ever get a Governor's Scholarship award. So we're really talking about students that are sort of a little bit higher up in the band, somewhere probably starting around 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 EFC. And as you move up, that there may be larger proportions of students that are receiving the Governor's Scholarship. So if you took a student, just as an example, who's receiving a partial Pell Grant, and that same student we were to give a Governor's Scholarship to, the Pell Grant would prorate in a way that, you know, syncs well with the actual tuition, whether a student's moving up or down. But for that student who has a lot of need but not a zero EFC, the Governor's Scholarship changes dramatically. So that's how you end up with a cost for students if you were to award it beforehand. What we do to avoid that, again, is we simply don't award students, I think that goes probably for all the directors, until after the freeze or census date, a few weeks into the semester. That way we can know for sure that, you know, if this student dropped from 12 to 9 or went from 9 to 12, we can cover their full cost. And typically that's done through the institutional aid, the set-aside.
Carrie, if I may, just for those in the audience who aren't doing this for a living day and day out like we do, there are two things we're really talking about here. There's cost of attendance, which actually is sort of federally defined as including direct charges, tuition and fees. They include a non-direct charge that the schools can work up for books and supplies. It then includes at a residential campus, room and board. At a community college, it allows for what I call living stipend amount, travel, and miscellaneous expense. So the cost of attendance is significantly higher than tuition fees and what we allow for books. One of the things that we purposely designed into the Governor's Scholarship Program was the ability to spread this money as far as we could among the neediest students to give them the basic free education, and that's covering tuition and fees and $1,000 for books. Again, this is somewhat a result of the reductions in appropriations. It no longer seemed feasible or even, you know, something that could be defended very easily to families if one student walked away with, say, a $1,000 refund check from state dollars and another needy student was left without any. So we took away the cost of attendance component that Pell allows. When they prorate Pell,
Pell will cover tuition and fees, and then there'll be some left over. So the student can get a refund. That's a federal rule. They allow that. We purposefully changed that in the Governor's Scholarship Program, again, to try and get as many of the neediest students, part-time and full-time, the free tuition and fees and books.
Jen, I believe you have a question, and then I have a question or two after that.
Well, I just have a comment, because I think that it's not necessarily community colleges versus public. It's not public versus private, community colleges versus 4 years. It's really populations that we're serving. So, I mean, if Albertus were here, which unfortunately she wasn't able to make it, I think she would echo a lot of what you were saying about the adult population and confirming their enrollment, and they want to get them in summer. And then, like, Albertus offers a bachelor's degree for adults, and it's in the evening, and it's 5 weeks at a time. And so I think that the adult population is looking to, if we were to serve them better, it might need some more flexibility in terms of the cutoffs and the dates, and because there are just a more fluid population of students. And then with the four-year full-time students, I think that those institutions are really looking for the predictability in advance, because that's how they get students to enroll in their colleges. So I think it's different issues, and that's, I haven't heard of a state that has a separate program for adult learners or for part-time students. I might be something to ask ECS how other states deal with this, but it really, the populations have different needs, and so the program is doing its best to serve everybody with limited resources, with the goals that were outlined when it was created, which was full-time completion. But I think the strategic plan has laid out that we need to get more adult learners back and get them post-secondary credentials, so that's just something to think about. How do we serve them better?
Thanks, Jen. Oof, voice cracked. I'm getting to feel like it's last call. The lights have gone on and the screen was pulled up, so I guess that I'll take that as a signal, although I do still have a lot of questions I would like to ask. One is it codified that we're trying to encourage people to go full-time? Again, given the realities of the new student body, right? The number of high school students graduating are declining. We've hit, gone past the top of the baby boom echo. I forget what it is, 1.8 to 2% a year. They're expecting a decline in the number of high school seniors going in for full-time, and that we know to hit our 70% number, we do need adults coming back. In 70% number, meaning our state goal is to get 70% of people with a post-secondary credential. It doesn't have to be a degree. It can be a certificate. But we know we need adults to come back to do that. And in that fourth goal of broadly inclusive, I think that means, in my mind, that is including those part-time who can't go to school full-time. But that's a long way of asking, is it codified that we're incentivizing full-time? So Roberta answered, that's yes. Okay, thank you. So that would be something then that we may need to look at if we're going to try to bring that as a recommendation.
Since I was involved in that change, I do want to comment why it happened. We were trying to encourage students to carry a larger caseload, larger credit, because we know that their completion rates are much better. The more courses they take, the sooner they complete. So that was the thinking behind it. So it was well-intended, but we don't, in this building, we don't manage these programs. And I think the issue for me, or the takeaway here, is how would we redesign this? Because I think that's what I'm asking publics and privates. How would you ask us? You need to tell us how you would do this to make that work, or doesn't it work at all? And for Mark and OAGE, it sounds like it's very cumbersome for you as well. So maybe we overstepped, in terms of trying to establish policy like this. So if you could please help us with this, because, it is something we can change, right? I mean, would you like us to do that? Thanks. Okay, I'm not getting any. Okay. So that would be really helpful if we could get that information from everybody, the privates and publics. The second one is the prior issue. Is that something that works its way out in a few years, or is that something you would like the legislature to address? Okay. So everybody's happy the way it is.
No, I mean, I think that we would love to be, I think it would be great if we could send in data, and I don't know what the date would be, but for the prior year, so that we could have a sense of the percentages early on. Like in the fall, so that
The timing wouldn't have to change. It's just that we would have 1 year where we...
Well, except if we wanted to include summer or something like that, but...
Well, they can include summer. That's actually an enrollment column on the report. So the timing wouldn't necessarily change. It would just mean what I get at the end of 15-16 I won't look at until 16-17 because I have 14-15. So that, you know, again, it's not that big a change for us to accommodate.
Okay. So that's a good outcome. That's a
But again, keep in mind the ability to project. As you pointed out, depends on the budget variations. I'm always hesitant to put out estimates that may be way off.
Any?
So, Mark, one of the questions I had is you just mentioned that summer is included on the data report. So is it possible for a student to count for more than 2 points?
No, 2 points is the maximum. It's a good question.
Okay.
We decided 2 points is the maximum. There are very few students that show up on any of the school reports that are full-time, the three periods of almost as much as. Nope. Again, as I said, we don't prorate because the award amounts are not prorated. That would tie into how Pell works, but we don't prorate that part-time student's award in half. We don't take a $3,000 award and say that six-credit student will get $1,500. Because it's so much less, we can't count them. The award amount is dramatically less, yeah. Correct. Well, again, it gets back to the original intent of this program. What it was trying to achieve is the full-time enrollment.
But sometimes we make mistakes here, Mark.
If I can jump in, I think you'd probably be hard-pressed to find any public, private, any financial aid director, any family member, any student who wouldn't want more predictability and earlier information about their financial aid award. So I don't think you would get much pushback from anybody around here, at least, about moving to prior year. You know, Mark's suggestion of maybe using the same year twice in a row would potentially achieve that. That gives more time for reporting, more time for review, more time for awarding, more time for us to be able to say to students, this is what you're going to get when you're comparing schools. When you're deciding, you know, again, to speak about community colleges, when you're deciding to come to school, to be confident that you're going to be awarded some amount of money that's going to allow you to attend, to be able to get that information earlier and be confident about it is only going to be useful. But I think it's really those two separate things of prior year that has been brought up, and also more proportional awarding to part-time students so that the funds can be allocated to individual students earlier.
That's
can say for the four-year publics, I mean, prior, we're all talking about it already. We've already started looking at the data, what we have to do. So the early predictability would help us a lot. If we plan to start awarding in December for the following year, it would be nice to know up front versus just being totally exposed.
I'd just like to observe that our budget for the current biennium was not finalized till late June this year. So I think we would all aspire to predictability, but when the budget's not finalized, I don't think that we can move forward and provide certainty when there's no certainty on the appropriated level. So I think that's always going to be our struggle. And again, I think Governor's scholarship and state aid is an important and significant component of student financial aid, but it's not the only component. And I think institutions have had to already find ways to be flexible, and they've used institutional aid because that's within your ability to award. And I think timing issues will persist with Governor's scholarship.
And just to touch on kind of what Jen mentioned earlier, is our schools at least are timid because we don't really know what our appropriation is going to be. I mean, we've seen a school that's lost more than $1 million over a 2 to 3 year span. I mean, how could they in any good faith start to throw that money out to students and then have to draw it back or come up with it institutionally? It's something that we can't do.
Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about that's on this sheet, and I certainly sit on one, is how the foundation support comes into play when you're making these awards. We haven't talked about that. We've listed all the pieces, but I'm certainly aware that some schools have significant foundation aid that comes to them. So actually, it's been interesting in our situation. I'm on Northwestern's Foundation Board. We have a lot of money that sits on the table that students don't ask for. I don't understand how that, quite frankly, that's a mystery to me, why there's money out there that never gets applied for. So it's just something. I don't know, when you're making that decision and you're waiting for the appropriation, is there some flexibility in terms of individual foundations to help close that gap, at least with the publics?
Yeah, and I think that's where the institutional aid reflects the transfers from the foundations into the institutions. And also at the publics, it's the tuition set aside, which is, between 15% and 22% of every tuition dollar set aside to be redistributed in institutional aid at the publics. So that's the source of the funding for institutional aid at the publics. And the privates have, in philanthropy, their foundations or whatever mechanism, they raise the money and they redistribute it in institutional aid.
Let me see if I understand something correctly. So you're saying that when we look at institutional aid, that includes foundation support?
It does.
Well,
it's the amount that they choose to transfer to the institution. So they may whatever amount they transfer to the institution comes from the foundations.
Come sit up here. You don't have to sit in the, the cheap seats. This is too. You're welcome to come.
My name is Margaret Malaspina, and I'm the Director of Financial Aid at Capital Community College. We are the college that Steve just noted lost $1 million from when the Governor's Scholarship Program began. And it, I think, primarily is based on the fact that the majority of our students are not full-time. So I would request that if consideration is being given to award students the Governor's Scholarship as the Pell Grant is prorated, to also consider allocating the money in that same fashion. Additionally, Capital's enrollment is down 14%. I have no doubt it's related to the reduction of the $1 million. It's just, we're never going to catch up. We're going to propel downward if that continues. As for our foundation, we do not get foundation money allocated into our set-aside. So the state funding is imperative to our students. Whether they're adult learners or traditional age students, they don't, at least 70% of our students do not attend full time. As Greg noted, persistence is key, and if the funding's not there, it's not going to happen. So I thank you for your time, and please take these into consideration.
I'm wondering if we were able to include certificate students, if that would be able to, excuse me, if that would be able to boost our allocation based on the point system.
Can I feel like I have to say this. I hope everybody understands that every time we add something back in here, it's the pool is shrinking. The pool shrank last week when we had a cut to the governor's scholarship. So just, we would love to be able to do all of these things, but you just really need to, you know, certificate programs and part-time, and none of these decisions were easy or you particularly like them, but we have to really remember what the end result is here, and it's a diminishing pool of money. Just in the, we're looking at a half-year, you know, cut to the governor's scholarship. These are kids that were awarded money, will not get it in the spring semester. So I just felt like I needed to say that.
We do understand that, Jane. Thank you.
And just to clarify, the governor has not recommended a cut to governor's scholarship, right? Right. I mean, other parties have, and the governor has not.
Can I just ask a point of clarification? Are students in a certificate program, a credit-bearing certificate program, not eligible for the governor's scholarship?
Correct.
Right. No certificate students are able to receive this fund.
So, but if I came in telling you that, well, never mind. Okay.
And I think that's an important point, that it's a zero-sum game, right, in that whatever money we increase for part-time right now, we're taking away from full-time. And so we understand it's an imperfect process, and we're trying to allocate it the best way we can according to our state goals. One idea I had that I just want to put on the table for the part-time, again, we don't have the money, I don't think, to prorate it as we would like it. What if we prorated instead of out of 12 credits, out of 15 credits, right? So if you attended for 6, you would get 6/15 of the money instead of half of the money, as one way, again, of incentivizing people to go to take more credits, but also recognizing we don't have that much, you know, as much money to give them as we would like.
I guess to sort of indirectly answer that, without as much math, because it is still early in the morning. The reason that we're doing what we're doing at the community colleges in terms of awarding students after the census is not because we can't. We could guess and have a pretty good idea of some of the students that would be eligible for funding. But what we practically do is we ensure that as many students as possible, and some of our institutions are able to do it for most of the students, as many students as possible get their tuition, fees, and books covered. So in other words, the proration in and of itself, the total amount is definitely an issue. We agree completely. That's a major problem for us in terms of funding students, you know, and spreading that out to more students is theoretically problematic, but in practical application, what occurs is, let's say, I know any given student is only going to get $450 in governor's scholarship. I'm going to award that student, probably manually, Housatonic set-aside money, institutional aid, to cover the rest of the bill. I'm not going to leave that student with a bill. And that's how it will work. So if you were to change the proportionality, all it will do is allow the institution to do that earlier. Because it matches the proportionality of the institutional grant, which pretty much mirrors the Pell Grant, All those funds would interplay in a way that we could just award them a certain amount of money earlier on, and we would know that even if they drop lower, we're not going to have to change the type of grant that they're receiving. So in other words, I'm not going to have to reduce their governor's scholarship, or that's not even really how it happens, but you know, I'm not going to have to reduce their Housatonic grant or increase their Housatonic grant to tie in with what they're getting from the governor's scholarship. And it gets really complicated after that, and I don't even know if that makes sense to everybody, but more or less what happens is we cover everyone for as long as we can for their tuition fees and books, and all that, the primary thing that would occur from a change in the proportionality is we'd be able to do that earlier to make it more predictable for students in terms of knowing that they're going to get aid for the semester. We recognize that that predictability would continue even if funds were to stay at this diminished level overall. I don't know if anybody has a different thought about that from the community colleges, but I think that's pretty much how most of us do it.
James, I just have a quick question. Are you suggesting moving the state definition of full-time to 15 credits?
No, not moving the definition of full-time, but for prorating, using that for prorating the part-time award instead of prorating it out of 12 credits. Again, just so you're giving, currently we give a smaller amount, right, than the, and so again, it would just kind of bump up what they're getting now, and it would just change the formula, basically, for how you're allocating the part-time to increase it. But predictably, kind of increase it related to their credits.
We would then still do the same thing, James. It would just, you'd just be giving us different numbers. Mm-hmm. You could change the number tomorrow for half-time students to $718 for the spring, and we would have to work accordingly to make sure that the student is covered. So the proportionality may be, unless it mirrors, you know, if it's more, if the proportion was 100% for everybody across the board, no matter if you're full-time or part-time, that's equally a problem, just as if you were to change it to a different proportion that, you know, doesn't mirror, that's lower than the Pell Grant. So sort of either way, I guess.
Thanks. Just a clarification in my own mind, then a comment. Originally, I thought I heard earlier on in the discussion that students who were participating in certification programs were eligible for some form of financial aid. Now, recently, in response to what Judy had said, So in fact, they do not qualify for financial aid. Is that correct?
For Governor's Scholarship Program.
Right. My comment relates to the fact that I was at a manufacturing place yesterday. There are other ways that students who are in certification programs can get financial aid by way of the step-up program or by giving businesses credits so that they will pay for the training and education of people who go through certification programs. So there is another vehicle, another avenue for doing it. And then my final comment is really to reiterate what Jane had said. Particularly after we had our budget hearing yesterday, we really do need to be mindful of the fiscal reality in Connecticut, not just for this year, but probably for the next 3 years. So anything that we do, I would urge people to be extremely conservative and cautious given the fiscal outlook of being over $4 billion in debt over the next 4 years. And that isn't even really debatable. That's by consensus. So it's not a question of whether people want to do it or believe in it. The question is, where are you going to get the money from it to pay for it? And we certainly don't want to put ourselves in a position of making promises to which we clearly do not have the money, at least in the foreseeable future. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a lot more questions, but I'm going to ask two more, and the rest, if it's okay, I'll ask you offline if we can get together and discuss those. One, unobligated funds are returned. What is the amount of those per year? And then what is done with that?
In actuality, it's very little, if any. It was in the old KIC statute also. It actually was January 15th. Most schools don't run up against that problem. We get it occasionally. How much is returned is in the thousands to maybe low 10,000. It's in the big picture negligible.
Okay, thank you. Another thing, you know, we know one of the other state goals is affordability. And we look at affordability, I guess you can increase the aid you're giving to students, but then if we can reduce costs for colleges. And there is it's a highly contested study. It's not a great study, but Vanderbilt found that the cost of compliance is $11,000 per student per year. It's inflated because they have a hospital, and you're looking at the $2 billion cost of compliance versus $115 billion that colleges get in federal money. So I guess it's small relative. But that being said, there is a cost to colleges for compliance. Looking at your data sheet and the P20 Win data sheet, is there any way we can streamline for the colleges the data that they are reporting and utilize, you know, again, to make that easier for them? And I've heard from some schools that the cost of compliance may be greater than the amount of grants they'll receive, which, again, doesn't make sense for them. And that's a business decision, I understand.
When the Governor's Scholarship Program was originally proposed, we met with the schools about the data reporting requirements. And there were certain fields that were mandatory to get the data that the state needs. So we went over very carefully with all the financial aid reps and a lot of the institutional researchers, their IT folks, about what fields, and we came to a consensus that the fields that exist today are acceptable to everybody. I can't speak to the cost other than my impression from talking and working with a lot of schools. It was a one-time setup of the report. Now it's a canned report.
I guess my question would be, is there, and that may be then to P20 wins to them, but if we can consolidate the two data reporting to make it easier.
Yeah, we could certainly look at that. I mean, we have no problem with that. We can talk to who P20 and see.
Thank you. Jen?
Can you just explain a little bit about the need merit? And how it's administered, because my understanding is that there was some money that sort of floats back and forth, and I know that it's gotten better, but can you just explain how it works, how it's allocated?
Well, it's allocated to the student. The student, in effect, has an application submitted through their, in most cases, their high school guidance office. If they meet the qualifications, we look at their FAFSA data, make sure they're going to a Connecticut school. If they have an EFC, we offer them an award. Now, just as every financial aid office in this room does, and everyone in this country practically, we technically over-award because we know historically there's going to be a percentage that end up not going to an eligible school. So there's no money floating around. We over-award and expect a certain amount of students to end up changing their plans. It can float between colleges. In, say, March, I may think 10 kids are going to UConn and 11 are going to Central, but then they tell us, oh, we changed our plans in May, and now 15 are going to Central instead of UConn. You know, we make those changes at the student level. So.
Well, but the money goes to the institution, so that you give them a roster in September, and so then they have to straighten out. That student didn't enroll, right? So then how do they, I mean, so it is sort of floating between institutions.
No, because we over-award. We're counting on a certain percentage of students through primarily the rostering, also hearing from students during the summer, that they are not in attendance.
So one thing that we've heard from schools is because they find out need-based aid first, or they have more flexibility on it. So they award that, but they package students in March and February. They give them a need base to a certain number of students. Then the student finds out about the need merit, and they have to pull the need base because they can't get both. And so because the timing of things is what it is, sometimes students, you know, they read in their award letter that they got need merit and that they can't get need based, but they don't always register that. And so in some cases, the schools have to pull the need based aid after they've given it to them, and the students are feeling like they weren't counting on both. And so, and that's a new, because you used to be able to get capital and a kicks or a cap. Now you can't. And so I understand why you can't get both. I mean, I don't know why we have both, because they're both based on need. Why don't we just have a need-based program? I get why we have a merit component, but I think that with limited resources and we want to serve the neediest students, why make it so complicated and have two programs?
Well, that's a good question, and Carrie looks like she wants to respond to it.
I would just also say that any funds that can't be awarded in that fiscal year, there's automatic carry-forward provisions. So if funds remain unspent at the end of the fiscal year, there's no action required by the General Assembly. Statute automatically carries those forward into the next year, and that would be added to the appropriation in the amount that OHE can award. So it's not as though any dollars are left being unspent for student financial aid.
Let's follow this in terms of the need merit. Is that something, if we didn't give as much in need merit, there's a bump there, would that change? Could go to adult learners. I'm just trying to massage what we're trying to do here. We're trying to get adult learners in. We obviously want to spread limited dollars out. Do we say it's easier to administer for everybody all around if it's just based on need?
Roberta, Connecticut loses a lot of traditional age students to other states. And the one, you know, we want to retain our best and brightest, particularly of the needier class. And this is one way that we can help do that. The timing, I understand. But I think it's always valuable to have, and it's a relatively small portion of the funds, go to the need merit, to encourage those students who tend to be a little bit maybe more motivated academically to give them a higher award, to kind of reward them for their hard work, and hopefully that they'll keep on pace.
Okay. If I could just make a suggestion, is that in the letter that is, because the students themselves are notified directly that they may be eligible for, let's say, the maximum $5,000, perhaps we could just change the wording in that you may be eligible for an additional $2,000 in governor scholarship money because of your merit, and then that way you're not pulling away and adding money. I mean, in their mind, it's...
That would be up to the schools to do that.
Doesn't the notification go directly from OHE to
the... We don't know what a school may have, say, in March, offered a student in need-based governor scholarship. We only know how much a student who's eligible for the need merit is eligible for. So we send them awards saying you're eligible for a $5,000 governor scholarship need merit.
Okay, but initially they were eligible for $3,000. So could we just, again, send them the letter to say you may be eligible for an additional $2,000 because you've met the merit, or?
We don't know that particular student was offered governor scholarship at the school, because the schools, again, have a limited amount. So I can't say you're eligible for an additional when I don't know that they got any to begin with.
So we could say up to $2,000 more or some. Yeah, right. Okay. I think we're parsing words here, but just to try to make it a little simpler, so they're not feeling they're pulling something back from them.
I think that we do in our letter say that you cannot get both, though.
We do.
I mean, it's. Yeah. And, you know, again, people read what they want to read. And but it's not like it's not known, and it's not, people haven't said that.
But here's why I say the schools, and I don't want to put more work on schools, and I certainly understand how difficult it is for them, but they have, at the time they offer a need-based award, say in March, they also know that student may be eligible for a need merit, because they understand the EFC range and the SAT, ACT. So if this was done, it would be easier on that end, but I'm not saying it's easy. But they have the bigger picture than we have.
I mean, I'd like to hear from other schools, because I just don't know if it really incentivizes students to stay. I mean, I think it more incentivizes students to stay in state if they got a grant up front and their package was better than Scranton in Pennsylvania. And it doesn't really matter whether it's need merit or whether it comes from OHG. It's that
they're just happy to get an award.
Right. Okay. And so, I mean, I understand the concept, but I don't think it's effective. And also, don't they remain eligible for merit regardless of how they're due in college?
Their
grades doesn't matter. Their GPA, right?
Well, it matters for whatever the school has set for their satisfactory academic progress. And we do have students who lose it when the roster comes back and the student's not making progress.
I would just really caution about, I mean, we K through 12, you know, you're supposed to work hard, you're supposed to succeed in school, and I understand there may be another population, but it would be a dramatic departure not to award on the basis of merit some portion of those financial aid dollars. You know, we have the University of Connecticut gives, you know, they give merit awards to people that are outside of the state. So, I mean, I think that, you know, you got to be really careful about we remember 15 years ago, everybody was fleeing, and that was the reason we wanted to keep students in Connecticut, smart kids in Connecticut.
I don't know the answer to this off the top of my head, and maybe I should have done my homework first. As far as what other states, maybe Northeast states, do they offer two different types, need and merit-based, or is it just one award?
We should ask.
We can find that out.
I know there's been, with limited resources in states, there's definitely been a shift. I mean, I can get a study on it. There's definitely been a shift away from merit, because it state merit doesn't incentivize students to stay in state. I mean, there's studies that show it. And I get it, Jane. I understand where you're coming from, but I think that with limited resources, there's absolutely been a shift away.
Jen, do you know our schools in the state, you just speak for CCAC, are they pulling away from merit awards also and going to grant?
I can ask them. But, I mean, I think why not leave it up to the schools to use?
Because I think the philosophy might be the same.
But, I mean, but the schools, let the schools incentivize to get people in with merit, and let the state goal be access and affordability, not merit. You know what I mean? So, I mean, if our goal says we need to get more low-income students to college, it should be we getting more low-income students in college, regardless of what they did in high school, right?
No. Ours is a need component. Remember, ours is a hybrid. When you look at some other states who went away from it, they had pure merit.
I think I feel like I need to comment here in terms of when we all sat down to look at combining all three programs into one, KICS, CAPS, and Capital. And I think there was a sense, a certain sadness of getting rid of the merit with the Capital, because, and of course, Capital could go in-state or out-of-state. In terms of everyone's leaving the state, if you want to make me crazy, stop saying that, because it's not true. And we are actually a state that takes more in than we export. So we got to remove that from the conversation. But I think this whole issue of merit is an important one, because as you look at the increasing cost of education, and somebody giving you $1,000 more is just doesn't make you. Now, it could make a difference if you went to a state school, if you went to Central or Southern. But if you're talking about making a decision between going to Penn State versus, Trinity, let's say, that $2,000 is not going to, you know, and that's where I feel institutional aid and foundation monies should come into play. My way of thinking.
I'll send you the studies that actually that's just not true, because for a low income student, $1,000 or $2,000 could be the gap that they have at Trinity that they could go or not go. They could say, I can't enroll in Trinity because I have to borrow $2,000 more, so I'm going to go somewhere else because of that $2,000 gap. So it doesn't matter about the cost of the college. It is about the individual, and every dollar honestly counts. And for low-income students, I mean, $1,000 or $2,000 could mean going to college and not going to college. So I get it. But
no, but I'm just saying in terms of the merit piece.
Right,
that mean,
exactly.
I mean, wouldn't you just say it should be need-based and leave it at that? And then if a school really wants to recruit somebody above and beyond, then that's their, that's what they should be doing, not us. I understand, because I was part of the conversation of why we did the merit, because people felt really strongly wanted to keep students, our best and our brightest, in Connecticut. I'm just saying I do not think that that is, you know, and I understand what you're saying, Jen, but I really don't believe that's the case. Yeah.
I was going to say, for a lot of our students, when they receive the merit award, they're very happy about it because it says merit on it. So they enjoy that part. That really means something to them. I mean, we switch the money from a need base to a merit. You know, hopefully they get the bump in $2,000, so there's no difference in that. In the end, you get more grant money, but it does mean a lot to them.
It means a lot to the parent to see the merit. That speaks volumes, but, you know, obviously at this point in time, we're trying to figure out how we move forward with less money. For instance, I'm a big advocate of allowing, you know, going towards certificates programs being eligible. But the reality is there's not enough in the pot to go around. I'd love to incentivize certificates. And I also think that we need to do something about summer session. As for the part-time student, I think that should be a piece of what we, the package is for a student for the whole year, so that they can use it that way. Yes.
You know, maybe I think this is what Jen was trying to say, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that I think what we're trying to shoot for the students, and I'm not taking away that merit's important, and that extra money, you know, is very important, but let's make it as simple to the student as we can. You know, and if for us, you know, they get a need-based award and no wait, now they have a need merit award and no wait, now they have an academic incentive award, that's a lot of stuff going on for them. And they already have enough filled with their academics and being a college student as it is. So, you know, I think this maybe piggybacks on some of the federal movement on, you know, one grant, one loan, one work-study program. Let's maybe make it simple.
And Mark and Jane, I want to thank you very much. You know, we've been here over 2 hours now. I appreciate your time. You know, this is the Student Financial Aid Working Group, and I guess the main part that the state controls for financial aid is the Governor's Scholarship Program. So it was very important for you to be here to answer the questions for us. So I do appreciate that. I don't know if anyone has any other questions or how soon they're going to come remove us from this room, but...
I just want to say I thought the conversation today was very, very helpful. And I'm going to call on all of you to help us figure out how to do this. And I do believe it should be as simple and as clear to students. It is an overwhelming task to put together finances. But again, we're trying to match our financial aid policy and align it with our goals for higher education. So that's our goal, getting to the neediest students, reducing, you know, making it incentivizing for them to go, period, and not being a barrier, but also helping them to complete, and then at the end of the day, graduating without owing a whole heck of a lot of money. So, you know, unfortunately, the trend is going in the other way. So we as a group need to help crack that. That's all of our charges. Thank you, James. I'm sorry to...
So not hearing, not seeing any other questions. I think we will adjourn. I want to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. Our next meeting date will be... Shoot for 2 weeks. Okay.
September. Maybe the 17th or Thursday, just have the 17th.
Okay. So tentatively December 16th at, would 10 a.m. be okay? 10 a.m.? Do you want 10:30? Yeah, we'll return to then to the 10:30 December 16th and we'll send an email for confirmation. I won't book anything afterwards so I don't have to come earlier. Thank you. Thank you again and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.